Well, that's happening with regard to current income. And you know the ways in which it's happening. I'll quickly run through them in a moment. But not only are they taking wage shares. It used to be that wages improved as productivity improved, so profits improved, but wages also improved. No, not anymore. So not only are they taking current shares, but they're taking past and future earnings. And the way they're taking past earnings is they're looting the pension funds, retirement funds. Can you imagine? They're looting, they're taking the savings that have gone into home mortgages. That's past earnings of workers. And how are they taking the future? What do you think debt is? What do you think it means when college students graduate with huge debts that they will be paying for the rest of their life? They are taking future earnings. I mean, this is capitalism run amok. But the attack on, I said I would try to explain a little bit the way in which they're shifting current earnings from working people to the investor class. Well, one way is by restructuring work itself. You know, some of you will remember when getting a job in a factory meant a kind of lifetime security. It might not be the easiest job, but it was a job if it had a union where you could hold your head up and you knew you would get retirement and health care. And you knew that it would be full-time employment. Maybe not only for you, but maybe also for your son. Fewer and fewer working people in the United States have work of that kind. Instead, more and more workers are part-time workers, contingent workers. They do not have union protections. 6% of private sector workers have union protections. If they had a pension, they may be in danger of losing it. If they had health care provided by their employer, a bigger and bigger share of that health care cost is being foisted onto them. The new workers that are being hired by their employer are being hired as second-tier workers without the same protections that they had. So work is a the work contract, the basic work contract, has been eroded. Then also, government regulations of work have been weakened. The minimum wage pays much less in real terms than it did when it was inaugurated. And each year, it pays less and less and less, even though we adjust it periodically, but we never make up for the decline in the real value of the minimum wage. Well, somebody told me that if we had adjusted the Paul, you may know this number. I heard $19 if we adjusted it to the real value in 1968. Is that right?
It would be, yeah, close to that. And if you adjust it with productivity, then it'd be, for the gross productivity, it would be even higher.
Right. So that was one, that's one way in which this redistribution, taking from the share of all of us and stuffing it into the mouths and pockets, let's call them the 1%, even though, as Paul Krugman pointed out repeatedly, actually, it's the, what, 1/10 of 1%? another way is the campaigning against unions. This also began in the 1970s. It's a campaign that took the form of resisting union certification in the first place, campaigning to get existing unions decertified. And in the course of, you know, employers in the United States before the 1930s, they used to hire goons, spies, and thugs to beat unionists up and things like that. Now they hire, but those businesses went out of business after the 1930s. Now a new kind of union busting firm has developed, and it is flourishing. They don't employ thugs, they employ lawyers and PR experts. And these union busting firms are doing fine. And they're doing fine because employers have determined, have decided, and they've been successful at this, to resist unionization, to roll it back at every opportunity. First, in the private sector, you know how to scare people. You have trucks labeled Mexico drive up in the middle of the night, and somebody sees them and says, oh my God, the company's going to leave if we vote union. And now, of course, the attack is on public sector workers as well. What else? Oh, another form of redistribution. The cost of the public sector, you know, with all this really crazy propaganda against government burgeoning on all sides, it's really so nutty because business needs government. I mean, you can't have a complicated economy without regulation and without infrastructure, and it seems more and more without subsidies, especially from state and local government. Business needs government. Business, in a certain sense, is government's greatest friend, and that's one of our problems. But the campaign it's not really against government. It seems to be against government. It's really against whatever government does for the rest of us. So, in the light of that campaign, business has also fought to shift the tax burden. They're not against government having revenues. They're against government having revenues for income support programs for old people or poor people, for health care. Yeah, that they're against. But they want government to have revenues, because otherwise how could government subsidize their operations? How could government give them the big contracts for military hardware? So they don't want to eliminate taxes or really slash everybody's taxes. They want to slash their taxes and raise our taxes. And then in a complementary way, there also has been a campaign against programs that gave income supports to who? To poor people. To mothers raising kids on their own. To disabled people. To people disoriented by the instabilities of urban and capitalist life. Those people shouldn't get any support. Did you follow the recent debates to support a big cut in the food stamp program?
Yes. Yes.
And did you follow some of you aren't old enough to have followed it, the endless debates about welfare reform in the 1990s?
Yes.
Incredible debates. So anyway, how can we reverse this? Because I have to wind up. Well, I suppose the conventional answer is that we have to elect better people to make public policy decisions. And, you know, unlike many of my left-wing comrades, I don't poo-poo that kind of effort. I'm really a big advocate of democratic and progressive electoral politics, and I am I've spent a lot of my life in the trenches for electoral reform, voting rights reform. I think we need progressive officials, but we can't leave them there alone, because they won't be progressive if we leave them there alone. The exigencies of campaign finance make that simply impossible. It's not going to happen. You know, I'm tired of blaming Barack Obama for being oriented toward Wall Street. He is what he is. So why aren't we making more trouble for him on the other side of the political spectrum? I think we need movements for another flowering protest movements, like the a bigger, angrier movement of fast food workers. Now, if that were to happen, and I think it is happening actually, if that were to happen, I think you actual or future public policy experts would have an important role to play. In the 1930s, policy experts began to analyze the impact of American capitalism, of the American economy, on inequality and poverty, and how that had contributed to the collapse of 1929. In the 1960s, the same happened. I mean, in a sense, public policy experts were taking advantage of the new political climate that was created by the elections and movements of the 30s and the 60s. And that made them better policy analysts, much better policy analysts. Instead of endlessly examining the data on the relationship between childbearing and poverty, they began to identify the bearing of the big economy on inequality and poverty. That matters. You, we, I, we contribute to the public opinion out of which elections and movements grow. We are an important influence, ultimately, because the journalists, TV and newsprint alike, the journalists do read us. And you know, business leaders know that. That's why, for 40 years, business has been working hard to try to change not only the climate of public opinion, they've gone pretty far in that, truth to tell, but to change academic, expert opinion. And we've sort of held our own. We have to not only hold our own, but we have to become bolder and louder. And that's very important for American democracy. Thank you.